Right, just real quick, the big picture of 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 1, what does he begin with? Where does he begin putting the minds of those who receive this letter?
Going to face persecution, or is that too broad?
Well, in 1 Peter particularly, he addresses the persecution. Here in chapter 1 of 2 Peter, what's he doing is he's preparing them for what we're really studying about in chapter 2. He does something in chapter 1.
Well, the need for the proper knowledge of God and the keeping of that and the diligence we need to keep in our lives to always be prepared for every situation, really.
Okay, exactly right. Really, to be grounded in the truth, to grow, if you will, in the grace and knowledge of the Lord, as he says later in chapter 3. In chapter 1, he really spells out some details about that. Add to your faith or supply in your faith these various characteristics, various virtues, that you'll be a strong Christian so that you will have the entrance into the everlasting kingdom so that you can make your call and election sure. So be very well grounded. He goes on to talk about the idea that I'm reminding you of these things. You need to know these things because what we told you about the Lord's return wasn't a fable. It is reality. He's going to come back, and the underlying thought of that is you're going to be judged. You must give an account for your life here. So in chapter 2, then, he kind of gets into the heart of it about the false teachers. There are many false teachers. They're out there. They're teaching destructive things. They're alluring people away from the truth. And these people are doomed to destruction. And so you do not want to be caught up with them. But you can be delivered. You can be one who's like Lot. Though you're surrounded by this, you can be delivered from that and stand strong. And so you need to make sure that you're counted among them. So then, beginning in verse 12 then, as he continues discussing these false teachers, and really here is their true nature as he gets into it. Let's read chapter 2, verses 12 through 17. And Jack, will you start us out, please?
These, like natural fruit, these natures be caught and destroyed, speak evil of the things they do not understand, and will utterly perish in their own corruption.
And will receive the wages of unrighteousness, as those who count it pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you.
Having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, they have a heart reign of covetous practice and are accused children.
Forsaking the right way, they went astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the hire of wrongdoing.
But was rebuked for his iniquity, the dumb ass speaking with man's voice forbade the madness of the prophet.
These are wells without water, clouds carried by a tempest, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever.
Okay, so what he points out here is that really when you pull back everything, this is the false teachers. This is what you see as the embodiment of the error. This is where it leads to. This is what kind of people they are. So their shocking depravity, really, of these false teachers. This is their ultimate condition of a heart and a soul that's consumed by carnality. They're not driven by the higher purpose of serving the Lord and honoring His name and helping people's souls to be saved. They're driven by their own selfish desires. And so here's the picture. Here's what you need to know about them, because that's not the picture that they present. They present something very different. But you pull that back, here is who they really are. So he says in verse 12, what are they like? They're at the very beginning. Okay, brute beasts. What's he meaning by brute beast? They're like this.
It's like an animal that destroys. I mean, it's basically an animal that's just wild and destroys. It's really kind of what it's saying, because they need to be destroyed.
Okay, that's what they're appointed to. That's where they lead to.
But I mean, that's the animal mindset. I mean, it's just like when we put animals down today. You know, a crocodile goes and eats somebody and hunt it down and kill it. I mean, because of that, this is, to me, is the same description. He's saying you got a law,
okay,
law in that destroys souls.
Let's back up there. The crocodile going to destroy, let's say he eats a kid, like famous Disney World thing, right? Where the kid, the crocodile got to the little kid. So what about that crocodile?
That was his natural
instinct. It's just following the way that it is. That's just the way it is. So what's he saying about these false teachers? What are they doing?
They're doing the way they want to do.
Yeah, they're just following a base, and what we mean by that is depraved instinct. That's all that they're following after. Connie.
There's really a contrast here between the end of chapter 1, where he talks about true prophecy as an evidence for the deity of Christ, and the fact that he's coming back again. Now, these are false prophets here, and this, there's such a contrast between them. Back in chapter 1, he said the prophecy was a light shining in a dark place till the day dawned.
Mm-hmm.
They start arising in your hearts. And here now, these false prophets are just the very opposite of all of that.
Exactly right. Exactly.
They do have an agenda. That is their makeup. But this is on purpose, that they have an agenda to accomplish, and they'll do whatever at the ends of their means to accomplish this purpose.
Right, exactly right. They have no conscience against what they are doing. Just like the crocodile, it eats a kid. That's what crocodiles do, right? They eat stuff, and it doesn't bother it. Your dogs, the way that they behave. At times, we may recoil at what a dog might do, or any animal. But they're just animals. They follow that instinct, and that's what these people are doing now. So he says there that they are made to be caught and destroyed, as Craig was talking about. You know, this is what you do with them. But they speak evil of things they do not understand, and will utterly perish in their own corruption. They don't have the basis or the proper concept or understanding or grasp of things and speak evil against them. They speak when they shouldn't be speaking. They condemn when they shouldn't be condemning. But that's what they do. And what's the end result there in verse 12? What does he say this is leading to? Okay, their own destruction. Can you think of any examples in the Bible of where this happened?
Well, I'm thinking Moses and Hiram. Is it? I'm mixing the names up for they.
Kor, Dathan, and Abiram.
Yeah.
Okay, Jude actually uses that as one of the examples of judgment. So, what happened with those guys?
Well, they tried to rebel against God's established authority. And he put Moses in place, and they tried to basically overthrow him and overthrow God, and that led to their destruction.
Not only their destruction, but who else?
Their families. Belongings. Yeah.
And their belongings, and many other men. If you go back and read the account, there were hundreds who perished in that destruction. So their rebellion against God's way led to their own destruction. They thought, we're going to establish ourselves, we're going to be leaders here, and it ended up in their destruction.
Great Egyptian army, as the water came back, they were all destroyed, the whole army.
All of them. They stood up, Pharaoh in particular, thinking he could challenge God, and God wasn't going to control it, and he would, and God showed him he would not. Is there any other?
Really, the Sodom and Gomorrah, I mean, those men said, you know, well, you came here as a judge against us, Lot, now we're going to deal with you worse than we were even going to deal with these people, and so, but their destruction came upon them.
Exactly right. I'm going to bring up one more in just a minute. Hopefully you'll maybe see the connection in here, but it goes back to the old truth, principle, that we reap what we sow. You know, Paul brought that out. You sow to the Spirit, you reap of the Spirit. You sow to the flesh, you reap of the flesh in Galatians chapter 6. And he's saying these people are sowing to the flesh. Peter is. They're sowing to the flesh. They're going to reap that. They're going to get what is owed to them. What are they doing that's really shocking? Verse 13 says they will receive the wages of unrighteousness. Doing what?
They count it pleasure to riot in the daytime.
Okay, to riot. What are some of the other translations there? Okay, carouse. We maybe in modern terms think of a riot as, you know, the protests and busting windows and looting and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But really, what's he talking about here?
Talking about carousing in the day, partying in the day. Usually the things like that, the people that do evil, they do it at night. These people don't even care to do it in the daytime in front of everybody.
Bold just to be out there carousing, you know, drunkenness, debauchery, sensuality, all those kinds of things, the idea of the carouse, and that's what they're doing.
Well, it talks about earlier that when they first come in, they kind of come in undercover. Now they're not coming in undercover. They're being very blatant about it. They don't care when it's done or who it is that knows it.
Right, exactly.
They're really pushing that agenda. They're really pushing it now.
Very bold about it.
A few years ago, the homosexuals were not out front. Now they're openly out front, completely in daytime where they want everybody to see them.
Yes, and challenging you to object. Mm-hmm. They're looking for opportunities to try to make you say, I don't like that, and then pounce on you.
And I mean, there's other stuff too, like the Mardi Gras and Woodstock and all of those. I can't think of the other ones, but there's other ones of the same.
I hope you're ignorant of most of them. Sure. We know that goes on in the world around us. But think about what he's saying here. Notice what he says. He says, they count it a pleasure to carouse in the daytime. What's the latter part of verse 13? While they feast with you, who's he talking about?
People are influencing them, Christians.
Brethren.
Among brethren. This isn't them partying with the pagans. This is them among brethren. They're not ashamed. They're not holding back. They're doing this in front of them. And the idea is now, some of the things you'll read about this, and it is Jude talks about, you know, love feasts, things like that. They'll say, oh, well, this is the Lord's Supper and all of that. No. The idea is brethren would get together and spend time together and socialize together, just like we do today. And on those occasions, these brethren would come in and they would just live a carnal and act in a carnal way. And it didn't bother them among the brethren. So their spots, their blemishes, their black spots upon the brethren, upon the church. And how bad is it, verse 14?
They have eyes full of adultery.
And what does that mean?
Well, it's just sins of the flesh. They can't cease from sinning. They follow their desires.
Any other thoughts? When they look at a woman, all they can think of is sexual activity. They're looking for and longing for sexual immorality, to commit adultery. They only see women as objects to be used. Connie?
No, he had his hand up.
Oh.
I was going to say, a friend of mine at work, he's like, yeah, we're both brothers in Christ. He's like, I know you've seen me buy alcohol before. He's like, we're all Christians, you know, but I like to drink and stuff. And I'm just looking at him like, I don't get that. That doesn't make sense. You know, he's like, we both believe in God, but, you know, it's like, you may not want to drink alcohol because of your beliefs, but, you know, I like to do it, so it's okay. And I'm just like, that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. Exactly right. And it doesn't make sense. Here you have those who are professing to be followers of Christ, mixing and mingling among brethren. They are carousing in the daytime. They have eyes full of adultery. In verse 14, they cannot cease from sin. What does it mean they cannot cease from sin?
They're insatiable.
Insatiable?
That means that they can't get enough.
Okay, they can't get enough. Any other thoughts on that?
Well,
Well, kind of goes back and it kind of reminds me of verse 12. It's almost like that's their nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They got themselves so depraved. This is just a natural, their natural way.
What do you have for your translation, verse 14? They cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. They have a heart
trained in greed.
Trained. What does that mean?
They violated their conscience so long, they've trained themselves in pernicious ways.
Exactly. That they have an ingrained thought. Their view, their attitude, their desires are trained this way. And what that tells us is, first of all, that's not natural.
Right.
That's not how we come into this world. That they have trained themselves to be this way. They have allowed themselves to go down this path. And because of that, they cannot look at it any other way. That's just the way that it is for them. So, that leads them to enticing others. Because they live in this way, they're wanting others to join with them. They're wanting others to do what they're doing. And maybe even get involved with them in this and also practice it themselves.
Well, I was thinking, and if these people, these false teachers, were once a part of them, if they were truly once a part of them, how did they ever get to this point? Well, they got to this point by not applying the first chapter about be diligent and to make sure you add all these things to your faith. They didn't do that. And so we can't take lightly the idea that we need to continually monitor ourselves and read God's Word. Some of us, maybe I would think, oh, well, I could never get to that point. Well, these people maybe thought that same thing. But over time, over carelessness, over the influence of the world and not checking themselves every day, they came to this point in their lives.
Exactly. Exactly. They weren't committed to the right thing and remaining disciplined in doing that.
And once they do get to that point, it's funny that you mentioned that their hearts have been trained so long that they get to this point where that's just the only way they think. When they get to that point, they say, well, I was born this way.
Right, yeah.
I've always been this way.
Exactly.
I've just been struggling inside myself. And we know a preacher whose son told him he was a homosexual, and that was his argument. But you know that he had fed his mind on that for probably years before he even said anything.
Exactly. Believing the lie, deceived and being deceived is what that is. Exactly right, Layman.
Time of Noah, the people, their thoughts and imagination were evil continually, day in and day out. That was the only thought they had in mind.
Exactly. So that's the way that people get there. It comes in among brethren, and then it impacts those around them. And that's what Peter's working against here. Look, this is how these people are. And you need to be aware of it. You need to be on guard for it. He says in verse 15, they have forsaken the right way, which we talked about before. There is a right way. And they've gone astray following what?
Balaam, son of Beor.
Okay. So question 4 asks, what shows the extent of Balaam's greed?
Well, he went along for a good long time when he was being bribed or offered a bribe. He went from one place to another, hoping somehow that the Lord would let him curse the people because he wanted the reward.
Okay.
Yeah, awesome. The second time he prayed to God, that shows God said, no, you're not doing this. And he asked again. I think that right there, it's like you wanted the money.
Right.
Love gain for the wrong doing.
Yes, exactly.
Well, and when God didn't give him that message, he found an alternative way to do it. He showed Balak how to get the people, entice the people to cause them to sin so God would not be pleased with them. So he knew an alternative way. He was set on it.
Okay. I'll have to confess that this account in Numbers 22 is one of those that just makes me scratch my head. Because Balaam went to God, God, can I go? No, you can't go. Second time, God, can I go? You go, but you say whatever I tell you to say. He went and God got angry at him for going. It's the way the text reads, puts the angel in front of him. You know, his donkey's going along. His donkey turns this way. His donkey turns that way. It hurts his foot. He starts beating on his donkey. And his donkey's, what are you doing? What's the problem here? I don't understand. What shows you that Balaam was not in his right mind?
He was talking to the donkey.
Okay.
Snapping into it.
But
that's true.
It didn't faze him. Yeah. When the donkey spoke, the way the account's presented to us, just like he talked to him every day. He was so intent, and that's the problem. The way that I understand that account is God told him to go, and then God got angry with him because he went. It's because he was supposed to go with the intent, I'm going to do God's will, but he went with the intent, I'm going to do it to get the money. That's why I'm going. And so God put the angel in front of him to shake him and to warn him, you had better do what I tell you to do. So then, of course, he went on, tried to curse him. God wouldn't let him curse him. And he ended up, as John said, well, okay, we can't appeal to God directly to curse the Israelites, but I'll tell you how they can cause God to turn against them, get them involved in idolatry and sexual immorality, and God will attack them and destroy them. So that's what happened. And if you keep reading through the book of Numbers, God had Balaam killed eventually in one of the battles. He destroyed him because of that. But yeah, here he is determined to get that reward, that bride that was being offered to him. Let's think about this for just a second. What is it that these false teachers are teaching among the brethren? We're going to get there, Lord willing, next week, but what is it that they are teaching? What's the spearhead of what they're doing?
Well, they're teaching them that, you know, really that God has, you know, is not, things continue to go on like they have been. We're doing what we want to do, and there's not any judgment coming on us. So plus,
okay,
why worry? You know,
okay,
you concerned?
Okay, the at the very heart and center of all of this is the Lord's not coming back. Okay, what kind of error is that? Is it doctrinal or moral error? The Lord's not coming back. That is doctrinal error. What does it open the door for, though? The moral error for them to go. Hey, 1 Corinthians 15, what was the doctrinal error? There's no resurrection. But what does Paul warn them about? 1 Corinthians 15:33. Okay, evil company corrupts good habits, corrupts good morals. You start teaching there's no resurrection, well, then eventually people are going to be, well, then we can do what we want to do.
This is all there is. Unless
what? Yeah. So doctrinal error very often will lead to moral error. Doctrinal corruption to moral corruption. So that's one of the things that's going on here. And the greed, when he brings up Balaam, greed and materialism lead to this as well. There's the idea of a doctrinal error being taught leading to moral corruption. But sometimes the moral corruption leads to the doctrinal error because people want to find a way to justify their immoral desires, their ungodliness, the sin they want to commit. Well, I need to find me a way to teach that this is okay to do, that this is all right. I think that's what happened with some of the marriage, divorce, and remarriage controversy, is it impacted people in their families, and they're like, okay, well, how do we now deal with this? How do we justify this? How do we keep going? Well, here's an answer to it, and the devil will present that. So that ends up happening at times. Now, one of the things that I wanted to bring out was leading to their own destruction. What happened with Judas? What kind of person was he? He was greedy. He was materialistic. And that led him to betray Christ. And then it led him to hanging himself. His own destruction, his greed led to his own destruction. I guarantee you, he had no idea about that when he went to negotiate for the price to betray Jesus. That he ended up, because the guilt overwhelmed him, he ended up killing himself. And he's the forever going down in history as the betrayer of Christ, and he's lost his soul. So, we have to think about this. The first century, is the first century the only time this kind of things happened among brethren?
No.
Can it happen? Does it happen today?
Yes. Yeah. Once saved, always saved, the same thing. In a lot of ways, where it leads to, like you said, a doctrine, Earl, it leads to morality that leads to your own destruction. I mean, that's why I go to services if I can't follow.
Right, in the broader world around us, but among brethren. Yeah. You think about the AD 70 doctrine. Well, the judgment happened in 70 AD, and, you know, all those things. And sometimes when those things first come out or we first examine them, we can't put our finger on, well, what exactly is the issue? Where does this lead? What does that do? Well, it leads all kinds of places maybe that we don't see, but it will lead there. You start getting away from what the Bible teaches about the Lord, about the judgment, about accountability, about all those things, it ends up opening up doors that are going to bring in more corruption, more sin, and of course leading to the wages of unrighteousness, leading to people's destruction, destruction of the souls. Any other thoughts? Connie.
Stephen, when I lived in Akron, we had a preacher that had kinfolks from there. He lived in California. He'd visit periodically. And at first, when he began coming, he was involved with some of the marriage and divorce era that was rampant in the area where he lived. He came, the last time I saw him, he said, I want to tell you, he called me aside. He said, I've left that, he said. I said, what led you to do that? He said, I got to noticing that the churches that tolerate this kind of teaching have become a gathering place for worldly-minded people who just don't want to serve the Lord at all. He said, it was very obvious, very noticeable that the caliber of people that gravitated to these churches, not what I wanted to be a part of.
Right.
So that's the thing you're talking about.
Exactly right. It comes in one way and it expands and it metastasizes, if that's the right word, into many other things, Doug.
And just a phrase you'll hear every once in a while, and I heard it years ago and it really stuck with me, is that sin will take you further than you ever wanted to go.
Amen.
Keep you longer than you want to stay.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
And you know, to your point earlier at the beginning of class, you know, I mean, there's some people that just seem like they're just inherently bad. But, you know, even news reports, you will see a history of people. They, you know, they didn't just wake up one day and get to this point. It was years of dabbling in, and then it escalated a little. Did they ever think that they were going to get to this point where they were going to kill their mother or kill their grandmother or stab or shoot or get to the point where they teach doctrine error right off the bat? You know, they didn't think that they were ever going to get there. And then they did. You know, it is. It's sad that you can see it at this point and then you can trace back. And then how sad it is that the majority of us really don't pay attention enough to say, hey, what do I need to do so that I don't get here? You know?
Right, and that's where Peter started out. Here's how you prevent this.
Well, that's just what I was going to say. If you really back in verse 4, you know, sometimes we don't think about all the things that the Bible gives us in order to be successful in life and to keep us from these harms, but he says he's given us exceedingly great and precious promises that we can be a partaker of the divine nature and escape the corruption that's in the world through lust.
Yep.
I mean, that's a great thing. I mean, considering where everybody else is headed and the lives that are living.
Exactly. We have to keep our hearts and minds trained and focused on those promises, or we can be pulled away. You have something?
I was just going to say something about how far it progresses. We have a good friend of the family in the 50s. He was a gospel preacher, but in the institutional argument, he went with the institutional brethren, and later on became an elder. And just a few years ago, he was lamenting to my father about how all this social gospel stuff got in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just bothers him so much what the church has done and what they're turned into. But yet he won't leave that because of all his relationships.
Right. Right, exactly. Entangled in it, and it's tough to get out. Exactly. So, just wrapping up in verse 17, there are wells without water, clouds carried about by a tempest, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. What's the general idea there?
No good is what I think of.
Yeah, no good. Well without water?
Yeah.
Just a big old hole waiting for an accident to happen, right? So, yeah, it's a false hope, and there's destruction that comes along with it. That's exactly right. Okay, so let's read verses 18 to 22 and wrap up chapter 2 here.
For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error.
Well, they promise them liberty. They themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage.
For if they have escaped the corruption and pollution of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome. The latter end is worse for them than the beginning.
For it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than having known it to turn away from the holy commandment delivered to them.
What the true proverb says has happened to them. The dog returns to its own vomit, and the sow after washing herself returns to wallow in the mire.
All right. So here's the delusion of the false teachers. They have a call to liberty, but of course they end up putting you into bondage. What kind of words do they speak, verse 18?
Great swelling word.
Great swelling word. What's a swelling word?
Oh, man.
Just everything's great. It's an over exaggeration of, oh, it's just wonderful, it's great. Come and participate in this and be a part of this. And you know, life is so good over on this side of the fence, if you will. So great swelling words to enjoy the lust of the flesh without any kind of consequence. You can do it, it's okay. We're all doing it. It's great. All is fine and well over here. But who are they preying on? Who is it that they are going after?
Well, those who really have escaped that error, they're preying on them. And that's, you know, when you've been in an error, and then you hear, you know, and if you're not grounded sometimes, and you, that's something that's in your mind, that's something you've lived, or something that you've done. If you have somebody who really has that way to present things, you can get your mind to thinking, well, you know what? Maybe it's not so bad. So, I mean, we just need to be careful in our lives and teach our children, don't get involved in things because of the fact that once you're there, those things are ingrained in your mind, and sometimes it's difficult to completely overcome those things.
Right, right. It'll degrade you. It'll change your way of thinking. Preying on those who previously had escaped the sin. Think about this. These people, many of them had left paganism, and now they've been trying to live a pure life in Christ, and these people are saying, okay, you can act like a pagan, just be a follower of Jesus. And it, you know, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, so, Bob, you have something?
It was along what you were saying there. To me, they're so much more dangerous because, if you're living a corrupt life or you're doing things and an elder or somebody comes and you knew the truth or whatever, you're going to present a pretty good defense against them. I mean, it ain't going to overpower the word. Don't go that far with me, but they'll come up with some very, whoa, and if you ain't really ready for them, they could really corrupt your thinking about whatever you come approaching them. Like, if I'll give you an example, like Forsaken Assembly, you mean, he come to you and say, well, I've come 3 out of 4. Now I'm not forsaking nothing. You know, then they
sure
at that one time, but they can be pretty dangerous. Like a, what we're talking about, a beast, how they can corrupt your thinking.
Just twist it with the promise of liberty, Crystal.
They promise them freedom, it says.
Right. Exactly right.
So I keep having a little problem trying to keep in mind that these are all people that are like brethren and everything. So is this, because I have written it down because I was going to ask afterwards, but so is this before, and is this the reason why it came to be that we withdraw from members that fallen away so that this kind of stuff doesn't happen, or is this actually during?
That's true.
Because it seems like it's a lot of people going on right now that is doing it. It doesn't seem like it's like one or two. It seems like this big group of people that are having a big party that is trying to separate everyone.
So you're saying you're wondering why they haven't withdrawn from these?
No, she's asking about the doctrine of withdrawal. Is that why we have that doctrine?
Yeah.
Yes, we the,
to keep it pure.
Yeah, the doctrine of withdrawal, you go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, a man who had his father's wife, Paul said, you get together, you assemble, you withdraw from him. You deliver him over to Satan. You're to kick these people out. And he's warning against them. To these brethren here, this is what's going to happen if they are among you. They influence you and take you away. So, warning about that danger.
In 1 Corinthians 5, that group of Christians did not take any action against that. They were puffed up over that.
Puffed, proud.
That's something we just can't even fathom. I can't fathom that.
Okay, so they haven't withdrawn from these people yet then?
No.
I would take it they haven't, but of course he's not writing a congregation. He's writing Christians dispersed far and wide. And he's just warning you, here's people who will come in and corrupt you. So this may be happening at a specific congregation or somewhere, but it's happening just among brethren in general. He's warning against them, warning them against that error, that corruption that's coming in. Bruce?
You were asking, you know, who they prey on. And in King James verse 18, it says, those that were clean. So that's
yep.
The people that are being pulled down this hole of darkness is people that were clean, like you said, that escaped the error originally, but now they're being pulled right back into it again by brethren that they trust.
Right, that have influence with them. Because remember, the false teachers present themselves as dedicated to God, as holy, as everything's okay. I want what you want. They try to identify with you. They come as sheep or wolves in sheep's clothing. They promise liberty. What kind of things would be with that promise of liberty? What's the arguments people have?
Stephen, some of this has been done just by simply emphasizing that we've been too strict. Our teaching in the past has been too strict. We need to learn more about grace. There are several groups in the Bowling Green area that have been formed like this from members of the Churches of Christ. There are members in our area right now who are doing this same thing. That, well, I used to preach so-and-so, and I've learned that's too strict. So we need to learn this new liberty. And there are whole websites devoted to promoting that approach.
And our worship is too structured and too rigid.
Yes.
So we need to seek new ways to worship.
Right, exactly. You're free to do what you want to do. It's your life. You can do what you want, Connie.
In response to the question the sister raised back here about the doctrine of withdrawing from people, back to 1 Corinthians 5, he said, don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? That's one reason that you have to protect the rest of the church. It's for the benefit of the person that needs to be restored. We're trying to snatch them out of the claws of the devil.
Right.
For their own good, but it also has a protective quality to it for the rest of the church.
Exactly. Exactly right. And Peter's not dealing specifically and directly with that. There would be the other writings that deal specifically and directly with it. Peter's dealing with the influence they have, the true nature of it, and the fact that what they're telling you about this is a lie. They're telling you liberty, liberty, come out and live in liberty. You'll feel so much better. You'll be free and you'll embrace that. But question five is, why is it ironic that false teachers promise liberty? Do what?
I said it's just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The original message gives us liberty. The original message of Christ or of God gives us freedom from sin and peace with God, and that's liberty.
Okay. So these people are promising liberty, but are what? Verse 19. They're slaves of corruption. Every single one of us have seen people, either personally in our lives, maybe in our families, or we've at least seen it on the news, somebody who went to live life to be free is a slave of corruption. Drugs, alcohol, sexual immorality, all kinds of things. They are slaves to it. It is their master. And that's what Peter's pointing out here. Look, they're promising you liberty, but look at where they are. They're slaves telling you we can help you to be free. That doesn't make sense. A slave can't help you to be free. Who can help you to be free?
Christ.
A master, right? Your master, Christ.
Think about Jim Jones.
Okay.
Think about him, and that's been a long time ago.
Kool-Aid, yep.
But he convinced all those, how could you convince that many people to do all those things, to come and do that? That's to me, is a real good example of why he may not have been preaching the truth, but you can, it happens. So
yes.
Don't deceive ourselves to think it doesn't happen.
Yes, exactly right, Tim.
People say, well, we're already here, so might as well do this other thing too. You know, like he's like, yes, you know, we're already in trouble, so we might as well just do this other thing too. It's not going to be a big deal to add on.
Right. Just keep going with it. But here's something I want us to think about. There is no such thing as absolute liberty. It doesn't exist. We live in a time, in a place, we live in a culture where we're independent, we're free, I can do what I want to do. And you know, I'm all for that to an extent. Okay, politically, as a nation, you know, in business and economics and how I live, how I educate my family or myself, I want freedom. I want to be able to make the choices. I want to be able to do the things that I see are best suited for my family. But it goes too far, and it spilled over into the religion, into your soul, into your eternal destiny. People think, well, I can do whatever I want to do. Who are you to tell me what to do? I think I know what to do. There is no absolute liberty. You have a law that establishes liberty. The only way we have freedoms in this country is because of the law that says what the freedoms are. Here are the boundaries. And the only way we have freedom spiritually is because of the law of Christ that says here are the boundaries. You operate within those, you enjoy all the blessings, all the privileges that are offered, just like the Constitution, the law of the land. You enjoy these freedoms. It lays it out. Austin.
Yeah, go on with what you're saying. We've divorced freedom from the idea of rules or government or anything like that. And they're inseparable. They're part of each other.
Exactly. Well put. All right, so you have this liberty that's being promised, but they're slaves of corruption. They're slaves to Satan, who is a cruel and selfish master that's seeking only to destroy their souls. So then, where does he say this leads? Where does this go? Verses 20 to 22.
The latter end is worse than the beginning.
Yeah. Okay. They escape the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, through serving Him and doing His will, obeying Him. They've escaped that and again are entangled and overcome. The latter end is worse than the beginning. What does that mean?
Stephen, I'll illustrate this. In the 70s, we had an upsurge because these things happen in cycles. We had a big upsurge in Churches of Christ about this liberty and freedom. The Grace Unity Movement, it was called back in those days. One time, Don and I sat down and listed 70 to 75 preachers among our brethren that had been infected with this. And I was trying to analyze, well, what's the common element? And I finally realized, other than just shaking your faith in the pattern, there's no common element. Once your faith is shaken in the pattern, one of those guys became an Episcopal priest. One of them joined Eastern religion. Others went to the liberals. Others went nowhere. It just destroys your faith that there is a Bible pattern, like you were describing a minute ago about the perimeters and so on. Once that's destroyed, you are just blown to the wind.
Right.
Back to the wallowing in the mire.
Whatever suits your fancy, you can go there. You can find that path. Once that standard, once that pattern idea is taken away, you can just do whatever. Exactly. And we see it on steroids in the society around us with the religions, even the denominational world. They are in a very rapid downward spiral of how far they are going. And of course, it always sweeps up brethren with it. But Marianne?
This goes back to what John was saying about we have to examine ourselves. Back in verse 14, it's unstable souls is who they're after. They're after people who aren't examining themselves daily and aren't praying daily and aren't studying God's Word daily.
Right. And that's one of the reasons he talked about at the beginning, you need stability. Commit yourself to growing in the Lord. Exactly right. So they're entangled again in this. The dog returns to its own vomit. Anybody want to describe that to me?
I think that describes it pretty well.
Well, I mean, a dog has eaten that, has enjoyed that food, and it's been in his stomach for a while, but he regurgitated because it didn't sit. But now he looks at that and thinks, I'll have it again. And so that's what he does. And the hog wallowing in the mire, sometimes we just think that's a mud hole. No, that's not what this mire is. This mire is after that hog has digested his food, it has been excreted through his bowels into a muddy situation, and he lays in it and wallows in it.
Just so rolls all in it.
It's all in him. He's digested it, and he's done with it, but all of a sudden, it has another use in his life again.
Yeah. Anybody who's been around barnyard animals knows that happens, right? They'll get and roll around and all kinds of things and just cover themselves in filth and they stink and it looks nasty and all that. And he's saying that's what a Christian does. Now, let's be blunt about it. Not one of us would vomit and then think, well, I want to eat that again. Right? So why is it that if we, you know, get rid of the sin and we think, well, I want to go back into that. If we could just think of it the same way, that's disgusting. I do not want that. I don't want any, I want to stay as far away from that as I possibly can.
That's the key, though, thinking of it the same way. We don't think of it the same way.
Exactly.
Satan has put donut glaze on there.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Sprinkled it with sugar. I'm going to tell you right now, if it was sprinkled with sugar, I still wouldn't eat it.
Yeah. That's right.
But that's what he's trying to do. He's deceiving us. And the latter end is worse with them than the beginning. What's that idea?
I think part of that's got to do with the idea. It's hard to bring back. There you go.
Okay.
You go into it again. Mm-hmm. And it's worse because the chances come back from there sooner.
It's eaten away.
What are you going to say to them to prick their heart again?
Let me ask you this. Is there any validity to the idea of someone burning in hell and knowing, one time I wasn't headed here. One time I had heaven as my home. I had that inheritance laid up for me, and I gave it up because I went back into sin, and now here I am tormented.
The rich man remembered everything.
He knew the law.
Right. Doug, real quick.
One aspect that look at it is how we can look at other people, and we say, what a shame. They had everything. They had everything, and they threw it away.
Right.
They not know how good they had it. Now, that's one way of looking at it. That's being on the safe side of looking at the destruction of someone else. Can we get to the point to where, you know, we look at ourselves the same way?
No, that's too hard.
It is.
Exactly. And the warning here is for us. For us. Stay away from it. This is where it leads. Exactly right. All right. Thank you all. Lord willing, chapter 3 next week.